As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's Coolest Conversations podcast time, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. And this is the Mighty Manfred. Thanks again for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. Recently, it was Dion Week in the Underground Garage, and we celebrated the man, his career, and the release of his new album, Blues with Friends, which features the likes of Jeff Beck, Van Morrison, Brian Setzer, John Hammond, and others. Now, the festivities of the week included him joining me for a Coolest Conversations. Now, that week's coolest song in the world was Way Down, I Won't Cry No More. It's off of Blues with Friends, and the friend on that recording, none other than our very own Steven Van Zandt. We'll hear some of it now, followed by my interview with Dion on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Baby, put me way down, walking through the alleys of the midtown, thinking all about what she stole. I'm crying out alone, please save my soul. I had no money since midnight. I've been all on it this fine. I know whiskey don't last long. I'm crying out alone.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and my guest for today's Coolest Conversations is none other than singer-songwriter Dion DiMucci, whose career dates back to the first generation of rock and rollers, and we've been celebrating him and the release of his latest album, Blues with Friends, all this week in the Underground Garage as Dion Week. Hello, Dion. How are you?
Hey, Manfred. I'm doing well. A joy to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much, sir. Now, these are some pretty crazy times we're in the midst of. Have you and your family managed to stay healthy over the course of the virus so far?
Yeah, you know, we're doing the deal. You know, I live in a pretty cool place down here. We're doing the best we could with it, you know.
And where are you living right now?
Well, I'm like just a little north of Fort Lauderdale. Mm-hmm. I'm on a lake here, so when I go out, there's kids on bicycles and scooters and you know, they're on their roller skates and they're following their parents and there's young girls talking to their mothers. They're not on their cell phones. So a lot of good stuff is happening in spite of all the, you know, tragedy and horror in some people's lives that we're praying for.
Right. Well, you had a recent birthday, 81 years of age. How did you spend your birthday?
Well, first of all, I thought getting old would take longer. Well, I spent it trying to get a bigger cake because all the candles wouldn't fit on the cake that I had. No, I actually had a good time. I was talking to a lot of the people that guest starred on this album, you know, and they were wishing me a happy you know, day, and it went well. I'm a grateful guy, you know. I got a lot of love around me. What could I tell you?
Oh, terrific. Well, congratulations again. Now, it was back in 2016 when you and I spoke last, and we talked about the blues some then, and you said at the time you defined the blues as the naked cry of the human heart longing to be in union with its creator. That's a great quote. Do you think you achieved union on the new album?
Well, you know, I tell you, Manfred, when I'm inside a song, and it's riding that wave, like, yeah, you're just inside it. You know, St. Augustine said, when you're singing, you're really praying twice. It's like you really know who you are. You're connected. You're really connected. So, yeah, I feel that. I know that. Yeah, I get a great sense of that I'm fully alive. Yeah.
Well, the new album, you mentioned a lot of the folks that contributed calling you, giving you well wishes around your birthday. But let's list some of those folks. Just Jeff Beck and Brian Setzer, Billy Gibbons, Van Morrison, John Hammond, Paul Simon, our very own Stephen Van Zandt, plus a host of other talented folks. And from reading the album's liner notes, I'm guessing the idea of having all these folks come together and play with you resulted after you had worked with Joe Bonamassa on the tune Blues Coming On, which we'll play later. But is that right? Did the concept come from working with Joe?
It did, because I tell you, I couldn't plan it if I tried. I had all the tracks. I thought I had 14 of the best songs I've ever written. I felt that they were memorable, great stories, worthy to tell.
Yeah.
I knocked them out in about 3 days. I had the tracks. So Joe B came over the house. He heard Blues Coming On and he wanted to play on it. I said, hey, be my guest. And that just ignited it. You know, I thought, hey, you know, this is way beyond what I can imagine having somebody do on my song. I think it's fair to say that he ignited the vision, you know, and then I thought, hey, what if I get my friend Stevie Van Zandt to play on Way Down, you know? He might do something, and he did. Who plays like that, you know? Who's going to pick up a guitar and play like that? Nobody. So, you know, the thing just took off. And then I had this ballad. I thought Jeff Beck is the only guitar player that can make me cry when he plays.
Yeah.
And I sent them the ballad and he said, yes, I'd love to play on it. And I was like, I knew I was into something. I thought, you know, this is too much fun. It was thrilling for me to hear what great artists, their concept of what they're hearing, and they infused that on the song that I had. It was unbelievable. And when I finished up all 14 songs, and that's when I thought, you know, I'd like maybe somebody should. I got kind of like, I didn't want to stop, you know, it was so much fun. I thought, well, I'm going to ask Bob Dylan what he thinks of it, you know, and Bob wrote some liner notes for it. And man, when he writes, you always get to understand something you never did before for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
He's really knows how to, he has great insight. You know, we all know he's the greatest writer of the 20th century and beyond, and he won a Nobel Prize, but a lot of people don't know he's a great blues singer, and that's the reason why I sent them the album, because he's steeped in that tradition, and he had a lot to say about it, and I'm grateful, you know, that he sent me something. It was really nice of him.
Well, there are 14 tracks on the album. You mentioned the 14 songs, and we're talking some about some of the contributions. When did you start working on it, and how long has this process taken?
Do you know, I wrote the songs, I think, over a period of 4 years. I was just hanging out, you know, I was involved in the play, The Wanderer, that Charles Messina wrote, and it was so much fun being involved in that. And, you know, on the downtime, I would write a song or two. Then I had 2 months off, and I thought, well, I'm going to record them, you know. But it took about 4 years, I guess, to write the songs. And then I recorded them in a very short period of time and then start, you know, asking my friends to play on it. And believe me, it was less than a year, the whole thing. I mean, maybe 9 months. Once I recorded the tracks, I just started asking my friends. They started stepping in the studio and, you know, like with Stevie, I just spent the day. I had a great time, you know, at his studio, at his office, and it was a lot of fun. Then we went out to eat in the village, and we laughed all night. So that was a fun day, you know, and he's been helping me with the play also, you know. So
the album is produced by you and Wayne Hood, and he's credited as playing bass and keyboards and drums. I know he's down there in Florida. Can you tell us some about Wayne, how you guys met, and how you started working together?
Well, I was aware of Wayne, never worked with him, but I was aware of his guitar playing. He's a really fine guitar player. And I heard some things that he had produced. He's kind of a local guy, but You know, to me, he was just, you know, kind of a guy flying under the radar. You know, he just I heard some things he recorded, and I thought they were pretty masterful, you know. And I went to visit him. I said, Wayne, you know, I want this. Throw whatever, you know, you've been doing out the window. This thing is a band thing. And, you know, and I just want to approach it like, you know, two guitars, bass and drums, basically. I don't like singing with piano too much. I hate to, you know, I hope I don't offend anybody. But I love, like, Rhodes, you know, the keyboards.
Yeah.
So he can play those things. So we went in, and, you know, we did have a bass player on a lot of stuff, but we went in and just, you know, I cut them like I knew maybe the formats. I knew the keys. Right. I had been singing these songs for like 4 years.
Right.
So it like in 3 days, I knocked them out. I really did. I just knocked them out. And then I started doing some overdubs with my guitar, you know. And then to go into the studio with like a guy like John Hammond, you know, I was in New York. So we went in with John and he's just, you know, we've been friends for years. So he had his harp, he had his guitar, what do you want me to do, you know? And we just had a lot of fun, you know?
Well, speaking about him for a second, what was it, the tune, My Baby Loves to Boogie?
My Baby Loves to Boogie, yeah.
Right, he said, hey, I've got my harp. This song needs some harp.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We like to go out for dinner together, you know?
Yeah.
And Mahler and my wife Susan are really good friends. You know, we were all together, you know, and we just did it because my friend Joe Menza, his friend has a studio, and he has, you know, he has all these vintage guitars, the shop, and the studio's right next to his shop. So I know all these, like Joe Menza's a guitar player who flew under the radar. He plays on the song Kickin' Child. So it was like a family thing. One thing led to another, and it just was like seamless, you know. Crazy good, you know, and I asked Steven about it. I said, Stevie, I said, what do you think I should do? You know, you heard the album. He said, head for the blues market. It's a blues album, Dion. He said, you know, you've always been doing the blues. Ruby Baby, The Wanderer is a blues song. Yeah. He said, I think even Run Around Sue is a cleverly disguised blues song. So he said, you know, go for it. So it was a lot of fun, you know. So, I got to tell you, Manfred, I got surprised on every contribution or all this, you know, this masterful, mesmerizing, monster, distinctive guitar players coming up with an idea and infusing it on my song. Mm-hmm. I was like freaking thrilled every time they did something because I couldn't tell them what to do. I don't know what who plays like Brian Setzer. Nobody, just Brian Setzer plays like that, you know, very distinctive stuff. Once I heard a few of these contributions or these performances that these artists came up with, I realized how limited I am. I know how to write a song, sing a song, make a record, but I am limited. And I saw it, you know, and I said, you know, I'm going to go this route. This is too much fun.
Well, on 12 of the 14 cuts, you share a writing credit on those tunes with Mike Aquilina, who you've collaborated with before. And my understanding is, you know, you came up with words and the music, and then you got together with Mike at some point to finish them off. Is that how the relationship works?
Yeah, yeah. He has a great imagination, and he's a great writer, really. He's just my co-writer, we're good friends, my partner in crime, man. He's like the man.
How did you guys meet? How'd you cross paths?
You know, we met in Rome. I was on a bus.
What?
We got on a little tour of some cathedrals because I just love the cathedrals in Rome, you know, St. Augustine's and St. Peter's and St. Mary, just St. John's. I love these cathedrals. I just love visiting them, you know, and I was with Mike. You know, when I grew up in the Bronx, there's a little cathedral in the center of my Italian neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, in the Fordham section there. It's called Montcalmel Catholic Church, and on the back wall they had a plaque. I always saw it. It said, "Ignorance of Scripture is ignorance of God." Oh, and it said Saint Jerome. That's who they credited it. Mm-hmm. So it was a statue of Saint Jerome we were looking at. I don't know who carved it. Maybe Michelangelo, I forget. And I said to him, ignorance of scripture is ignorance of God. And he said, Saint Jerome, the thunderer. And I said, the thunderer? What is that? And he said, well, that's what they call Saint Jerome. He was a very, very, you know, he was an academic, a very bright guy. He translated the Bible a couple of times from Greek to Latin, from Hebrew to Latin. And he just knew language, a very bright guy. But he was very intolerant of people. He would curse at people and be rude. And I said, how come they call him Saint Jerome? I thought he had to be perfect. He said, hey, it takes all kinds to get to heaven. He was an intolerant guy. You know, he said, but a lot of beautiful, great qualities about him that, you know, influence people. And so, and I said, let's write a song, The Thunderer. And we did. We wrote a song called The Thunderer, you know, about Saint Jerome. I said, that's worth a song. And actually, there's a school in the Bronx called St. Jerome, and they adopted our song for their football team called the Thunderer.
All right. Fantastic.
Yeah, so that's how I met Mike. And after we wrote the Thunderer, we just, this was years ago, maybe 20 years ago, and we just remained friends, and maybe the last three rock blues albums I put out, we wrote, you know, predominantly all the songs on them.
You know, so our coolest song in the world this week is Way Down, I Won't Cry No More, and this is the one that features Steven, Little Steven, on the lead guitar. You mentioned his guitar tone or the sound he uses on the recording in your liner notes. What do you like about it?
Well, it's totally distinctive. You know, my idea of great art is like something very recognizable. You could recognize it.
Yeah.
You know it. You say, yes, that's a song. I get it. But there's something very distinctive about it. You know, there's something a little different about it. You know, like a Johnny Cash or a Bob Dylan or, you know, those sounds, you know, you say, wow, that, you know, there's something distinctive about it. It's different. So his guitar playing, I would say, lands in that arena.
Well, some of my other fave tracks on there include Uptown Number 7. That's the one with Brian Setzer, and Bam Bang Boom with Billy Gibbons. But to me, your song with Paul Simon, that is a real, real highlight, this song for Sam Cooke here in America. On your 2016 album, New York Is My Home, Paul sang with you on that title track. But with the song for Sam Cooke here in America, given the recent events, you know, George Floyd's death and Black Lives Matter, the ongoing struggle for racial equality, that song rings especially loud right now. Can you tell us what the story is that the song comes out of, and when and why you even wrote the tune?
Well, I wrote the song because I knew Sam Cooke and I traveled with him for about 6 weeks. And I wrote it a long time ago, never recorded it. But when I saw Green Book last year, I took it out of the drawer. I said, man, maybe you ought to take a second look at this song.
Yeah.
Because they wrote a movie so similar to my song. But here's the deal. I traveled with Sam Cooke for like, you know, I did two tours with him. He was a very, very refined, very intelligent guy. I was from the Bronx. I was kind of rough around the edges. He was a preacher's kid. And I saw him in a lot of situations, you know, some of them very ugly, you know, people calling him names, you know. And I'd say, hey, Sam, why don't you knock that guy's lights out, you know, and give, you know, throw him a right hook, you know. And he'd say, you know, Dion, I wouldn't lower myself to think like that. He taught me that it's a peculiar way to become a man, this racism thing. Mm-hmm. It's a very peculiar way to become a man. And if, well, basically he taught me that if race matters to you, you're a racist. That's what a racist is. If race matters to you, to guys like you and me, it doesn't matter. It's like eye color or shoe color. You know, we don't, who, you know, we don't, who cares, you know, it doesn't matter. But I got to know Sam and I got to observe him like up close. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd see the way he responded and the way he reacted in these different situations. And it was always differently than I would. And then it dawned on me why he was the way he was. He never got ruffled. He was the smartest guy in the room. And it appealed to me. He wasn't afraid to talk about God. He wasn't afraid to talk about a higher reality, higher ground, a higher pitch. He was an artist. He wanted to change the world. He did it through his music, through singing, through his writing. But most of all, he did it through brotherhood, friendship, understanding. And that's what the song is about. The song, I guess it has an undertone of racism, yes, but it's more about brotherhood. And I went to Paul Simon. I said, Paul, I have this song, and I think I hear you on it. And, you know, he got the idea of it right away. We were on the same page. He said he liked the idea, and he went into the studio and had these ideas because, you know, hey, we grew up with the Moonglows and the Cadillacs, and, right. you know, we did the song, and he just did something just so artistic with it. So amazing. Like, you know, like, over the top, you know, it's just, he made it something sublime.
When you were taking that trip, doing those shows or touring with Sam Cooke, where in the country was that?
Well, and we were in, I remember one time in Memphis, he took me, we were playing, you know, the main facility down there. I don't know exactly what it was. It was a big auditorium. And he brought me to see James Brown, who was at a small, James Brown and the Flames. Nobody knew who he was at the time. I mean, he was a local kind of guy traveling the South, James. And Sam took me to this club. And it was almost like racism in reverse. You know, all the people there were going, who's that guy? And Sam was like, hey, this is Dion. We're working together. And he's with me, you know. So it was kind of cool. He was a very kind of statuesque, beautiful looking guy, you know. He was, I miss him. I miss him. He really taught me a lot and affected me on a lot of levels, you know, and helped me raise my game and taught me not to deal with these, you know, peculiar people at that level. Right. Kind of mirror back to them how kind of stupid they are, you know. He showed me a way to do it, you know.
Did you ever perform to segregated audiences in the South?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'd have to. That's the problem. At the time, I knew there was racism in New York, but it wasn't the same. For some reason, I was recording with, you know, on all my hit records. You know, I had Big Buddy Lucas and Styx Evans and Panama Francis, all these black guys from the Apollo Theater, and they would encourage me and come into the studio and just, you know, help me out.
Right.
And so I didn't feel like I did in the South. It was like these guys had a dress on the other side of the stage. And then when you went into a hotel, you had to go to two separate hotels. And I'd have to go, you know, get a sandwich from a certain diner because they couldn't come in. You know, it was crazy. I got stories. God, it was different. It was, I just wasn't aware of the Jim Crow laws, you know, and all. I wasn't aware of racism like that in New York, you know, or in the North.
So, you know, I'm from the South originally, and I'm familiar with the Jim Crow laws and things like that. But you mentioned, you know, the racism was different in New York. How did it manifest itself there? Well, yeah.
No, it was quite visible in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, I brought Frankie Lyman home to, have, you know, to have some, my mother was making spaghetti, and I took him to the, you know, my house in the Bronx, where I was, you know, when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I took them up to the Bronx to have some spaghetti. And they were like, hey, what are you doing with that? You know, who the hell is that? I'm going like, this is Frankie Lyman. And I don't care who he is. So what are you doing? You know, like, hey, get out of here. You know, it just, it's a peculiar way to become a man. It just struck me very peculiar. You know, it's like, it's just very shallow. It's like a thin veneer of a man.
Well, the final track on the album, Hymn to Him, it features Titus Galfa and Bruce Springsteen, and you've done a version of that song before on this gospel album, Velvet and Steel. Why did you want to revisit it for the new album?
Well, that was the one song that, one of two songs, actually, that I recorded, and I really didn't like where it was. I thought it could live in a better place, so to speak. And so I did a version of it, and I thought Patty Scalfa, she's the Jersey soul girl. Mm-hmm. She's gonna give this thing some soul. You know, she's gonna like, I don't know what she's gonna, because I didn't tell any of these people what I was hearing. I figured they're the artists, let them hear what they're hearing. And I gave it to Patty, and I thought maybe she'd do some harmony on some lines and echo some words I was saying or do something like. Well, she did something totally unexpected. She layered her voice or stacked her voice maybe 12 times. She captured the wind of the Holy Spirit. You know, just mesmerizing, astonishing stuff. I was like, whoa, you know, and then Bruce comes in the room again. He has this, you know, his guitar, this big sound that he has, and he captured the, you know, the universe and beyond, you know, and it just gave the song such width and height and depth and beauty. You know, Manfred, it's like going to the Olympics, wanting to, high jump 19 feet and you end up catching a wind and jumping 23 feet and breaking every world record there. That's what this was like. It was like, I was happy with the songs, happy with the tracks. And then you get with these artists who take you on a trip that you weren't expected, or to a place. And you know, it's some place that you didn't expect and you love it, you know. Another great example of that is Samantha Fish. When I gave her the song, I had no idea I just said, Samantha, you have the passion, do your thing.
Her song is What If I Told You, right? That's the one she's playing on?
Yeah, What If I Told You. So she comes into the studio and she played on What If I Told You. And I just told her, I said, Samantha, I said, just do your thing. You know, you play with so much passion. She brought in a cigar box guitar. It has four strings. And she played what she calls a Northern Mississippi rhythm part. Uh-huh. And I liked it. I said, yeah, man, that's happening. Then she pulled out the Gibson with the humbuckers and just went at it. And Manfred, I can't tell you. If I put that much passion and emotion into anything, I wouldn't be able to walk for 6 weeks. She tore it up, man. It was something else, man. I felt like she was ripping my heart out without anesthesia, and I was enjoying it.
Oh.
It was crazy good, you know. And Stevie had that same effect, you know, that passion, that grit, you know, that just grabs you.
Yeah, man. Well, before we leave the tune, the Hymn to Him, you mentioned you going to Rome and you met Mike there and enjoying the cathedrals. And, you know, you had done that song, Hymn to Him, for a gospel album, you know, years ago. Are you still a practicing Catholic?
You know, I'm one of these, I was always a weird kid. at 14, I was reading St. Thomas Aquinas, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the church. I totally love the church. I know people try to beat it up and hit it with sticks, but yeah. I'm inside, I'm in the middle of it. So I just love it. I find a lot of peace and wisdom that you wouldn't believe. I'm going to say something that'll, sometimes my friends, it blows their mind. I said, if you open my head up, if you cut my, and look inside my brain, you'd find a very orderly place. And they look at me like, really? I say, yes, that's the way, that's what happens to me. I feel like I'm in God's presence. However you relate to that.
Well, at one point you were involved with the prison ministry, working with men dealing with addiction issues. So I was wondering, are you still involved with that?
Well, that's what happened. To be honest with you, that's the real deal right there. What happened to me, Manfred, is 52 years ago, I was 28 years old. Mm-hmm. And I used to, you know, Frankie Lyman and I were running the streets. Yeah. And we were getting high together and enjoying life. And he died in 1968 in February of that year. And it just scared me to my senses. Mm-hmm. And I went home and I was thinking of this for a month and a half. And April 1st, 1968, I got on my knees and I said a prayer. And when I got up, I haven't had a drug or a drink since. It was like I was changed. And I just became aware of like God's power because I said a prayer. I said, I need help. I don't know what I'm doing, you know? And ever since that day, I just got on like a spiritual track, you know, on a track of ancient wisdom. And I just stayed on it and I never looked back.
When we first spoke, you mentioned that you felt like you were on the right page when you can communicate like Hank Williams and groove like Jimmy Reed. Did you ever meet? Yeah. Did you ever meet Jimmy Reed?
I know, but I saw him at the Apollo. Mm-hmm. That's enough. That was enough. That was enough to change my life. Yeah. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. I wouldn't be talking to you, man. That guy, you know, there was nothing like Jimmy Reed. You know, that's the foundation of rock and roll, my kind of rock and roll right there. You know, you get like, if you fuse Jimmy Reed and Hank Williams, you got early rock and roll. You know, you got, yeah, Chuck Berry, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good turn of phrase, too. Is Jimmy Reed your favorite blues songwriter as well, or do you have a favorite?
I do. I would say he's like up there. And then, of course, Robert Johnson is, you know, just totally, you know, he just wrote such great songs and he was just something really special, you know, and Stevie Van Zandt and I, we bond on that, you know, we both have that in common.
Sure, cool. Well, right now we can take a listen to one more cut off the new album, Blues with Friends. And I want us to take a listen to that opening track, Blues Coming On. And that's the one that's got Joe Bonamassa playing on it. To me, his playing is, we agree, of course, it's really killer. And I love the kind of shuffle beat going on in there. And it's almost got this kind of, his tone and stuff has got this kind of Otis Rush, Cobra era vibe, or maybe even Jimmy Reed. When did you write that song?
You know, I just, sometimes I get a line and I want it to come out of my mouth and I just get fixated on the line. You know, if I didn't know better, I'd feel the blues coming. Well, the line, if I didn't know better, I wanted to write a song around that line. Mm-hmm. And I just had it and I just kept singing it. And then the whole song just developed around it, you know, and I recorded it and I wanted to do it kind of like an up-tempo John Lee Hooker tune, you know. And but Joe Bonamassa, when he got on it, he must play about six or seven solos on that. And he's an ensemble player. Manfred, he's like, you know, he's an amazing player because anything he hears, if you're accentuating a word or if you throw a sound out there or you improvise something, he senses it and he plays either like supports it or, you know, enhances it or, you know, he jumps on it and he hears it. So some of the stuff that he does on there, some of those solos sound like John Coltrane. Some of them sound like Miles Davis. Some of them sound like Thelonious Monk. I don't know what he's doing, but he's just like there's seven solos and they're all so different. And he's an ensemble player. I'm not. I know how to back myself up and write a song, mm-hmm. but he can play with a band. You know, he just hears the arrangement, hears your words. He's so attuned to what you're doing and what you're about to do. It's incredible.
Now, did you say earlier you had called him up and say, hey, come on over and play on this, or would you like to play on it? So is he living, does he live down there near you in Florida?
No. You won't believe this. This is an incredible story. His manager lives five houses away from me, Roy Weissman. So Roy, when I finished the album, and that's why Joe Bonamassa visits me, you know, because he's right at Roy's sometimes, you know. Yeah. So I called after I talked to Stevie Van Zandt. I you know, Stevie told me head towards the blues market. So I called right after I hung up. I called Roy. I said, Roy, I have an album here that I did with, you know, a bunch of my friends. In fact, Joe Bonamassa is playing. He said, gee, I didn't even know that. He said he played on one. I said, yeah. He said, bring the album over. So I walk over to his house, bring him the album. That night he calls me up. He says, Dion, I want to start a new blues label and I want this album to be the first album on it, Blues with Friends. What do you think of that? I said, I'm in. And that's all. That's what happened. That's how crazy it was.
Very cool. Oh, wow. Dion, thank you so very much for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Manfred, thank you. You stay safe. Stay strong. Be well.
I'll endeavor to do so, and you do too. Well, right now, I'd be lying if I didn't admit I feel those blues coming on. It's Dion with Joe Bonamassa off Blues with Friends here in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
I'm at the station. You took a train, standing waiting in the rain, baby. Something wrong. Well, if I didn't know that I'd feel the blues coming on.
Yeah, man, felt those blues coming on. That's Dion off his latest album, Blues with Friends. And the friend on that track, Joe Bonamassa. This is the Mighty Manfred, and a huge thanks again to Dion for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. Mickey Lee is Joey Ramone's younger brother, and his band, Mickey Lee's Mutated Music, have got a new single out on Wicked Cool Records called Little Christine. Joining me to talk about it will be the band's drummer, Mickey's longtime associate, Pat Carpenter. That's their next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens' Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it decide, baby, diamond ring.